That's what we're going to talk about this morning. But first, happy Thanksgiving. I hope you're all having a wonderful weekend. And big thank you to all those involved last weekend for our Into the Woods walk. I know Julie and Sarah and so many others helped organize that. It was just a beautiful weekend to be out and hiking in the woods. So a big thank you to them for that. As you probably are aware of, by now, you have been part of a social experiment this morning, which I will get to momentarily, but we are back into the Looking Glass stories of Genesis. And a few weeks ago, we looked at Genesis 1 and talked about this idea of God leashing up the monsters of chaos. And so as we move into the stories of Genesis 2 to 11, what we find are stories about these monsters getting off their leash. And these stories are archetypal. They're trying to express what you might describe as an unchanging, transcendent reality. These stories are describing, I would say, what's common across all human experience and all of time. And so these stories, you could say, are distilled reality or hyper-reality. And so if your question this morning is, well, did these stories actually happen? I would counter with the question, well, what do you mean by happened? Did it actually happen? I don't know. What I do know is that it happens all the time. And so these stories contain patterns about the human condition that are always true. And what this means is this for us. There is something about your life that is echoed in these stories. And so as we move into Genesis 2 and 3, what I want to suggest is that the story about Adam and Eve in a garden with a snake who can talk and a mysterious tree, it's a story that's trying to help us wrestle through consciousness. Human consciousness. And the story culminates with these words in Genesis 3, verse 6. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some of it and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened. And I don't think they were walking around blind before, so I believe we're talking about some sort of different kind of eye-opening thing, consciousness. And so the story is moving here to this moment when Adam and Eve wake up and become conscious. And so the story, if you backpedal it a little bit, it begins in paradise, in Eden. And the scene there in Genesis 2 is really a story of two people living in a walled garden. That's what paradise means. And Eden means a well-watered place. And if you remember back on Genesis 1 teaching, the idea here is that order and chaos are in perfect harmony here. And so they're living in what I would say unconscious bliss. But then it gets interrupted by a snake. And before that happens, though, there are three interesting setups in Genesis 2. First, a mysterious tree appears. Then Adam names the animals. And then we're introduced to Eve, and the concept of marriage and monogamy is laid before us, but to the tree first. What happens in Genesis 2 is fascinating. We read this. The Lord God commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat from it, you will certainly die." It's like, whoa. It raises so many questions for me, this passage. First, why is the knowledge of good and evil a bad thing? Why is it going to result in death? But more than that, part of me is like, what the heck? I mean, God's a really tricky character in this story. I mean, it's like, okay, if we can't eat the bloody thing, then why did you put it there in the first place, right? And more than that, it's like, of course you know we're going to. I mean, it's just there. How many of you looked in the box this morning? You did. Now, some of you, I was watching so closely, you were oblivious, just walked on right on by. It's like you didn't even notice that there are four boxes sitting around saying, do not look in the box. When you saw it, how many of you actually saw the box and chose not to look in? You guys, you're ruining my entire point here. All right. Unbelievable. You're so well behaved. Unbelievable. Seriously, there goes that point. Okay, I was going to be like, of course you looked in the box. That's, huh. All right. Well, maybe if we just left it there, you would eventually look in the box. I don't know. But it's like, of course they ate from the tree. I mean, how many times you tell your child, don't eat this? What are they going to do? They're going to eat it. And so we're human, we're curious. And I mean, this setup is so bizarre. And you have to wonder, what exactly is God up to here that says, here's this thing, don't touch it? And it's interesting because for me, this is why scripture has become so nuanced to me. Because if you're trying to make the case for God, you don't leave this sort of complexity in the text, in the story. I mean, you just wouldn't. Because God's supposed to be good. But God seems like a trickster here. And he clearly knows they're going to eat from the tree. Just like many of you looked in the box. Which makes me wonder if that's actually the point. There's a level of sophistication here because I don't think we're being sold this idyllic version of God. God is very complicated here. Why would he do such a thing? And so you have this mysterious tree. And then Adam is tasked with naming the animals. And the story ends with Adam feeling alone in the animal world. And I think the point again is why? Why is that there? Why does he feel lonely at the end of that story? Well, I think again it's trying to highlight for us the dilemma of self-consciousness and highlight how this is a distinctly human problem. Humans alone are self-conscious. I mean, there are studies that have been done, I find these fascinating, that if you put lipstick on a chimpanzee and show itself in a mirror, they will wipe off the lipstick. Which, is that not really bizarre? I'm just imagining in my head like this team meeting where someone's like, we gotta figure out if animals are self-conscious. And some guy's like, Bob, I got the idea. Let's put lipstick on them, see if they get embarrassed by it. I mean, who comes up with these ideas? But a chimpanzee, you put lipstick on it, show it in a mirror, it'll get a little bit embarrassed and wipe it off. Or dolphins, they seem to be able to recognize themselves in mirrors. And so there are these glimmerings of self-consciousness and recognition in other animals, but it's not even remotely close to being in the same category as human beings. Human self-consciousness is on a whole different level. We're the storytelling animals. We're the self-conscious animal. And so the predicament of self-consciousness is ours alone. Because animals are not aware of the future. They're not aware in a sophisticated way like we are of time and space. And so the story sets up this distinction. There's the animal world and then there's us. And we alone have this problem. And then Eve shows up on the scene and we're introduced to the idea of marriage as ultimate allegiance, as a partnership, the introduced to the idea, the concept of monogamy. And I got to tell you, I cut out pages here. There was so much stuff I would love to talk about with this story, but I need to get to the snake in the tree. And the way Genesis 2 ends is fascinating to me. It says this, Adam and Eve were both naked and they felt no shame. Bizarre setup here. Humans standing naked with no shame. I mean, why is shame associated with nakedness? It's weird. The whole nudity thing is a weird thing, but we got to talk a little bit about it. It's complicated because, first of all, people are kind of strange because we're hairless. Some of us more than others. But roughly speaking, compared to most animals, we're hairless. Remember at my brother's wedding, he got married at a destination resort, and he and I are walking along the beach one day, and he just stopped, and he said, look at you. I said, what? He said, you look like a shaved gorilla. I said, what? He said, seriously, look at your body. You look like someone shaved a gorilla, put on a pair of swimming trunks, that's you. And it was very hurtful. I said, well, geez. But when you think about it, being hairless is really bizarre. It's intriguing from an evolutionary point of view because no one really knows why we're hairless compared to other animals. And there's all these weird theories out there. Like one is that, in our past, we were running a lot in the desert. If you read a book like Born to Run, it says humans were designed to run and chase down animals. Like humans can run for like a week, tire a horse out, tire prey out simply by exhaustion. And so one of the ideas is maybe we lost our hair because we had to get rid of heat really quickly. Or there's this other guy, I love his name, Buckminster Fuller. If you're thinking of a baby name, that I think is great, Buckminster. And he had this theory as well about why we're hairless, and it's that he believes we used to spend a lot of time near the water because there's a lot of food there. And so he sort of refers to humans as the fish ape. Needed to find food around there so we could swim, and so we sort of adapted that thing. But it's interesting to me because what having so little hair does is make us much more exposed to the world in a way that animals that have a covering of fur simply aren't. And on top of that, we stand upright, which is very strange because most animals are on all fours, and so their vulnerable parts are protected. But for us, we stand, our vulnerable parts are exposed. And when you stand up naked without hair or fur, it's like your whole being is on painful display. It's like, ugh, what's that weird mole thing there? Or, ugh, that's a little unbecoming. And so here's the thing. To be naked is to carry with you the knowledge that you're exposed to the most serious possible evaluation of the quality of your being that you can possibly be. No one loves the idea of standing naked in front of other people, right? The reason why we wear clothes, all of you are clothed this morning, is that because it protects us from being evaluated too harshly all the time. But at one point, apparently we were naked without shame. And it makes sense because the only thing that could make us ashamed of being naked would be self-consciousness. And what could change that? Well, the story's headed there. So humans are naked and without shame. And then in chapter 3, a crafty snake appears. I love that it's called crafty. Now, the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. Crafty snake, such a good word. I mean, how else does a snake crawl into Kit's lap if it's not sneaky and subtle? Tricksy, false. And so I love this story here, what the snake does, because it does three things with Eve as it's talking to her. First, it tells Eve God can't be trusted, which is false. And then second, the snake tells her God is trying to pull a fast one on her, which is tricksy. And then finally, the snake tells her God will be jealous of her if she eats of the fruit. Tricksy, false, sneaky, subtle, crafty. So the snake tells her, if she eats, her eyes will be open. She can see like God can see. She will know good and evil. That sounds pretty good. And so, again, when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. Man, those lines are brilliant. You know, there's a lot of debate, of course, in Christian circles around the place of evolution in Genesis 1 in particular. And what I want to show you this morning, I think, is how evolutionary thinking actually does a whole lot to help us think through the story, actually, of Genesis 3. There is so much going on here I had no idea about. Just think about it. They interact with a snake, and they wake up. They become conscious. They eat fruit, and they wake up and become conscious. Have you ever wondered why humans see in color? Interesting thing is this. The answer from evolutionary biology is that the reason we see color is because of snakes. And so the elements of this story are not accidental. I want to talk to you about snakes and food, and consciousness. You know, Facebook is getting a little bit creepy to me. I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations about something, and an ad will pop up in Facebook. So my son Huxley, he had eczema on the back of his knee. I'd only ever talked about it, and now Facebook pops up an ad for eczema lotion. I'm like, that's crazy. And so this week, for whatever reason, all of these news stories about snakes were popping up in my Facebook feed. Interesting. Creepy, creepy. And the one story that I clicked on was this. This is the story I read this week. This past March, villagers on the island of Sulawesi, They went searching for a man who never returned from his work of collecting fruit in a palm oil tree forest. And instead of finding the man on their search, what they found were scattered pieces of fruit, a picking tool, a boot, and a 23-foot-long python swollen from a recent meal. You might have guessed it. When they sliced the snake open, they found the missing man dead and covered in reptilian digestive juices. That happened this year. But notice the story. It's uncanny to me. A man goes to retrieve fruit, encounters a snake, and is overcome by it. Oh, there's something very primal going on in this story. And it's interesting because here in Canada, we don't worry a whole lot about snakes. But for hunter-gatherer societies, encountering snakes was a very common problem. In fact, it still is today. A study shows even today, humans who dwell in jungle habitats, 5% of adults have been attacked by a python. Numerous children have been eaten. In some areas, it's higher. There's a place in the Philippines, an anthropologist studying the Agta tribe. In 2013, reported 25% of adults have been attacked by a python there. I mean, snake predation is no joke. In fact, I started looking for the numbers and I was blown away. Every year, 300,000 people are bitten by a snake. 100,000 people a year die from snake bites. I'm laughing, I shouldn't be. That's a lot. 50,000 of those are alone in India, one country. And they think that estimate is probably way lower. 100,000 people a year die from snake bites. This is a problem. It was no joke today for many people. It was no joke in our past. In fact, some would say it really shaped our evolutionary history. The anthropologist, Lynn Isbell, she claims that we're really good at detecting the camouflage pattern of snakes, especially in the lower half of our field of vision. And she's written a whole book that defends the idea part of the reason that human beings have such acute vision, aka we're awake and can see, is because we co-evolved with snakes. We learned how to see and detect them. And get this. This is where this stuff is blowing my mind this week. I've been so excited to share it with you. Lynn Isbell argues this: the price we pay as human beings for able to see so well, being able to see so well, for being able to detect snakes, is that our brains are huge. Our brains grew as we evolved because you need a lot of brain power to be able to see and color and detect patterns. So our heads got huge, literally. And do you know what the price of us having big brains and big heads as a species is? Pain in childbirth. Because we are conscious beings, our heads are too big for birth, as some of you know. And we give birth way earlier than most species. It makes our offspring vulnerable for years. You see a giraffe give birth? That's a weird thing to see, but you see a giraffe give birth, the thing is walking in 5 minutes. But as a species, our infants are dependent and vulnerable for years, and it's because of the size of our brains. And why did our brains get so big? To detect snakes. Snakes, consciousness, big brains, pain in childbirth. Come on. And it's all right there. And the price we pay for having large brains is that we're very dependent as infants. It takes a long time for us to get programmed and self-sufficient. And because of that, we need relatively stable family bonding. And so we need an institution like marriage so that women aren't duped into child-rearing alone. And it's all in Genesis 2 and 3. Lynn Isbell, by the way, she's not a Christian, so she's not coming at this with an agenda. She's simply an anthropologist and animal behaviorist. This is her book, The Fruit, the Tree, and the Serpent, Why We See So Well. She says this: from the temptation of Eve to the venomous murder of the mighty Thor, the serpent appears throughout time and cultures as a figure of mischief and misery. The worldwide prominence of snakes in religion, myth, and folklore underscores our deep connection to the serpent. But why, when so few of us have firsthand experience? The surprising answer lies in the singular impact of snakes on primate evolution. Predation pressure from snakes is ultimately responsible for the superior vision and large brains of primates, and for a critical aspect of human evolution. Snakes have influenced the development of human behavior, may well have given bipedal hominins, already equipped with a non-human primate communication system, the evolutionary nudge to point to communicate for social good, and a critical step toward the evolution of language and all that followed. Oh, man. What she says is this: snakes are ultimately responsible for our superior vision, for us waking up, being able to see so well. Neuroscientists in Japan and Brazil have confirmed her findings. There's concrete neurobiological evidence of past evolutionary selection for rapid detection of snakes. They opened our eyes throughout history. And it meant that big brains means pain in childbirth, highly dependent offspring. That means the need for the social structure of marriage. And it's all right there. I don't know. I am so excited right now. That just blew my mind this week. Anyway. And so, in our past, snakes actually opened our eyes. But there's another element. Eating wakes up Eve and Adam. The act of eating opens their eyes, which is another evolutionary adaptation. Another reason we can see so well is to be able to detect ripe fruit. And see, it's interesting. In the act of eating, their eyes are opened. They're transformed. And it's fascinating to me. I was reading this book this summer. It's called Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst by Robert Sapolsky. I've almost finished it. Man, this book is dense, and it's a little depressing because he argues there's no such thing as free will. Everything's biology. It's dense, depressing. In fact, he says, free will is what biology has not yet discovered yet. I thought it was a brilliant line. Made me kind of laugh. But he talks about this idea of eating as spiritual transformation. And we all sort of get this, right? So when you eat, what happens? Sometimes it's the most rapid spiritual transformation you will ever experience. Maybe you have a grumpy child or partner or a friend. Maybe it's you. What can almost instantaneously change our disposition? Food. Man, that person's being difficult to get along with. Feed them. Feed them. Like within moments, they'll be pleasant again. And the implications of this are kind of disturbing. I was blown away by this. What Sapolsky wanted to find out was, does this have any effect on the legal system? And so he developed and started to research whether this had any effect on how judges make decisions. So he started this big research project. So let's say this. Let's say you committed a crime and you have to go in front of a judge to plead for parole. Now, here's what Sapolsky found. It really doesn't matter what you did, and it really doesn't matter what you promise to the judge. What matters is whether you see the judge before lunch or after lunch. Because in his study, he found if you see the judge after lunch, you have a 60% higher chance of parole. That is crazy. So if you're ever in trouble with the law, make sure you book 1 p.m. That's the time you want to see the judge. But seriously, that is mind-boggling to me that food makes a 60% difference in how a judge treats someone. I also think this should be basic relational advice, by the way. Never enter a dispute when you're hungry. Feed them first, your partner, your child, whatever. Feed them, then you can manipulate them all you want, right? Just beautiful food. I have some requests. Okay. And it's just mind-boggling to me. The story of Genesis 3 plays directly on the things that actually open our eyes, snake and food. And so these humans become awake, aware, self-conscious beings, and they wake up and they realize we're naked. We're naked. And what does that mean? Well, like we've talked about before, to realize that you're naked is to realize that you're vulnerable. And to realize you're vulnerable is to realize you can be hurt. So they wake up, realize we're vulnerable permanently. It's never going away. And so immediately they clothe themselves, because that's what you do when you need protection from the world, when you need protection from the prying eyes of others, and why all of us are wearing clothes this morning. The point is they're naked and they're like, this is not good. We're vulnerable. We become self-conscious, and then they hide themselves from God, which is interesting. Why are they hiding? Well, again, they know they're vulnerable now. And what that means is they're very aware of their own inadequacies, which is true of all of us here as well. We know, I know, you know you're inadequate. And we know that, and so we look at ourselves and we think, how in the world am I supposed to live properly and well in this world with everything that I know that's wrong with me? And so we hide. And what do you hide from? There's a question. Go home tonight when you have some quiet time and ask yourself that question. What am I hiding from? What have I hidden from in my life? That's a scary question. And you ask yourself that, and you might find some really disturbing things because we're all hiding from something. Of course we hide as people. That's the thing to me that's so terrifying about this story. We wake up and think, I'm vulnerable. There's some serious trouble here. I'm not all that I could be, and so I need to hide. And then the story, it moves into the price God inflicts on humans for becoming conscious, for waking up. And I mean, the story is tragically comic. I mean, notice Adam here. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, sometimes I hear people say, oh, Eve gets the raw deal here. And I'm like, I think Adam looks way more the fool. What does he do? It wasn't me. It was that woman. And then he goes further. It was that woman that you gave to me. So twice, pass the blame to the woman and put it actually on God. I love it. And so now he's not only naked and ashamed, he's also a wretched, backbiting coward. Which, by the way, I would say isn't far off from what a lot of us males do when we've been caught and are vulnerable. Blame everyone else, not me. And because at least Eve has a good excuse, right? We already know snakes are subtle and crafty. Many people believe this is Satan himself in the story. So, hey, if you're going to get duped, Satan is not a bad person to have been duped by, I suppose. It's a better excuse than Adam has. And these curses are so fascinating to me. The price for being awake, for being conscious, is so intriguing and archetypally true. We already covered Eve's, but this is it again. Why is pain in childbirth so severe? Well, when your brain is huge, as big as ours, and you can see it's not that easy to give birth anymore, and you produce something that's incredibly dependent beyond belief, and that's Eve's price. Price of consciousness is delivering big-headed, big-brained babies. Leads me to wonder, is this the story about sin and the fall, or is this a story about describing the reality of the human condition? And for Adam, his curse is work. It's the invention of work. And what does that mean? Work is us simply sacrificing the present for the future. And why do we do that? Because we're vulnerable. Because we're awake and we're aware and we can project into the future. And as we look into the future, we know there are problems waiting there for us. And so you have to work. Sacrifice. I don't want to be doing this, but I need to do this labor to make money because in the future I'm going to need that for all these problems. But the weariness of work is that it's never enough. I can never work enough to solve all of these problems. And so we all live with these anxious lives about the future. That's the price of waking up. It's the end of unconscious bliss. It's the beginning of our story as self-conscious beings. It lets the chaos monsters off their leash. And yet, there's one final mystery to me about this story. And it's so odd. Because humans are now conscious and awake. They're aware of good and evil. They can't be allowed, in the text, to live forever because they know good from evil. And so they're banished from unconscious paradise. It's weird. Why? What does that mean? Why was eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil cause for such drastic measures? Here's the thing. What does opening your eyes and realizing you're vulnerable have to do with the knowledge of good and evil? I wanted to tell you something this morning that you would have never forgotten, but as is a good practice of mine, I read my sermons to Kristen, and she has made me very aware that some of us are more sensitive to details than I am. So I'm going to skip some of these details, but I'm going to point you to something that you can explore on your own time. You can open that box if you want on your own time. But what I want you to do, if you have the stomach for it, is when you go home, look up Japan Unit 731. But only if you want to have nightmares. You see, in World War II, again, I'm not going to give you details, don't worry. But Japan had a unit called Unit 731. And they were stationed in China. And they did some of the most horrific things that were ever done to someone in World War II, and that is saying a lot. And so look it up if you have the stomach for it, but even if you don't, consider the worst thing that humans have done and recognize this. That's a part of the human consciousness package. It's what we're capable of. I am capable of that. You are capable of that. Even this past week with the Las Vegas shooting, you know, everyone's vexed because we can't figure out a motive. Why? Why would he do that? And I got to be honest, I hope we never find the motive. Because when we can't, it has to stick to us. When you have a motive, it's way too easy to write it off. Oh, well, he had mental health challenges. That must be it. Oh, he hated Las Vegas. He hated country music. The moment we give ourselves a motive, it's a reason to set that aside and say, no, that's not typical of the human condition. But we are capable of that. And to me, that's the key. Here's the riddle to the key of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. To do evil is to ponder the things that make humans vulnerable and then use that against others. Here's the thing. You know you're vulnerable. No other animal knows that in the same way we do. You know you're vulnerable. You know what hurts you because you're vulnerable now. And that you know what hurts you means you can figure out what hurts someone else. And as soon as you know what hurts someone else, you can use that because you have the knowledge of good and evil within you. And that is the Pandora's box the tree opens. Japan Unit 731. Someone had to imagine, think, ponder the sick things that could hurt people, and then act them out. Las Vegas. I don't know if maybe he stood in a concert crowd one day and said, hey, we're pretty vulnerable standing in a big crowd this day, but somebody had to think up, this makes humans vulnerable, and I'm going to use that against humans. And you know, it's a pretty good trick the snake played in my mind. Because if you look over the past century alone, maybe even just this week alone, I'm not sure this is exactly the sort of thing we might have wanted to let outside of the box if we would known what the consequences would be. But as soon as a human being is self-conscious and aware of his or her own nakedness and vulnerability, we have that capacity to use that knowledge for evil, and it comes in all forms, from despicable, random acts of violence and torture to that simple barbed word you knew when you said that to someone it would hurt them. And we do it every single day. We're vulnerable and know what hurts. And that means I know what can hurt you. And we use that knowledge all the time. And with that knowledge, the cat is out of the bag. The monsters are off their leash. We're conscious now. We're vulnerable. And we know how to make other people vulnerable. And use that all the time. The greatest enemy of humankind is the propensity for evil, to use that knowledge of what hurts us against others. And so that right there, my friends, is in a nutshell the story of Adam and Eve. And with it, the monsters of chaos are now off their leash, and the rest of Genesis 4 to 11 is going to show us exactly what happens when that monster's off the leash. And again, it's archetypal. There's an echo of your story in all of these stories going forward. And so we'll leave it there. And next week, we're going to look at the brothers, Cain and Abel. And so I hope, in many ways, perhaps this story, you are hearing it in a way you've never heard it before. And I hope that it's giving you some pause and going, maybe there's a whole lot more going on here than I ever thought. And I hope that as we continue to explore Genesis and get into some interesting things there, it'll continue to challenge us and reflect our own stories back to us.